We're going to have so much fun today here with Ira Katz and Rick Walker. So Rick and Ira, you have both met many times before, and Rick is an entrepreneur, strategist, big thinker, and also the host of a wonderful podcast. And recent guests he's had are Jonathan Peugeot and Ben Carson and Brian Keating. So broad scope, but he has many wonderful guests on his podcast. And Ira has been here many times talking about Austrian economics because that's an area that he and I have a common interest in. So that was the subject I wanted to pursue today. And the two of you can take it any direction you want to, given that you have boots on the road experience, Rick, being an entrepreneur and an investor and starting many businesses. Ira has just had a lifelong interest in Austrian economics and well studied on it. But recently I saw this little video where an economist guy, I believe he's talking about Austrian economics, contacted Michael Levin, and he said, I think there's a connection between price and cognitive intelligence. No, in price as the cognitive glue of multiple intelligences. And I thought, well, that's exactly what we've been talking about for 5 years, is that price is a form of distributed cognition. So I'll just show you one of the opening slides from that episode so you can get an idea of the kind of approach that this guy is taking. Hopefully this will work. I'm not going to run any video. I'm just going to show a slide from it. Well, if I could get at it, I would. There. Prices as cognitive glue. So you can see the screen there. So
Yes.
this is his opening slide in this conversation with Michael Levin. And he says, in order to, understand his concept, you have to know the bare minimum economics, the general abstract principles of collective intelligence. And I think we both have that underpinning. So he says that the price system is the cognitive glue that makes this possible by connecting people across space and time. And his hypothesis is that all collective intelligences work according to the same basic economic principles. Now, when he says all collective intelligences, he's going down at least as far as getting down to the bottom of the cell level, and possibly even lower. We don't have to go into the science of it. I just want to talk about how price functions in the field of economics. And I also want to say as an opening salvo that I took a week-long seminar on Austrian economics in 1981, when I was a state representative in Iowa. I had an opportunity to go to the Foundation for Economic Education in upstate New York and take this week-long seminar. And when I listened to these guys talking, especially fell in love with Israel Kirchner and his absolutely amazing mind, I thought to myself, holy cow, this isn't just economics, this is the way the world works. It seemed to me that it just laid out the whole essence of reality in a sense. And so let's go after it from that standpoint. How does price work in Austrian economics? Ira, I'll let you start.
All right, I'll take a stab at this. I mean, well, one thing is in Austrian economics, another big part, a real fundamental part about it is understanding what money happens to be. So, we could talk about money prices or other prices. For example, if you have your artwork and I have cows, say how many cows, would you take, would the trade match? And then where there's this medium of exchange that in the Austrian view, goes back to, to a barter system, and whatever rises to the surface among who's ever trading as the most tradable commodity will end up being what's, the money that allows us then to, to trade my cows for for money, and then with that money, I can buy your artwork because you don't have any place for cows in your apartment, for example. So, that's a big fundamental thing. And in today's world of fiat money, that is money just created by governments, ex nihilo, from nowhere, and central banking, this is probably as important a topic to understand as any that exists in so the geopolitical economic world, I would say, because so much follows from that ability. In terms of, the price as then information, so it's the aspect of everybody in the market has an ranking of their values at any given time that then will use whatever resources they have to make bids on the market, say them, which, and it's even sometimes I think bad to call about the market or capitalism, of just the freedom to say to any other individual and say, you've got something that I think I could use, and I'm willing to give you something that's of more value to you, that is maybe some money that you can use for some other task or purchase or something, and the freedom to make that exchange. But in that exchange, a price is created only at that moment, at that place, among those people. But once that price is set and that information of what that quantitative number happens to be, and if it's in money, and money we can believe in, say some a gold coin or maybe a dollar, whatever we happen to be, then that information says something to all the other people who we can say are in the market or have the information about what is valued by different people. Is our cows valued, valued a lot by how much? How much art is valued by how much? And that information can tell them of, hey, I have cows. I could go on the market and sell them, or whatever it happens to be. And that process among the billions of exchanges that occur every day are the fundamental information about what's needed by society to, and what the producers, how they can produce it at what price in society, that essentially sets the information necessary for production. And that would be the case, I think, even in a non-industrial society. You still need to have a price. You still need an ordering of things. There's always a limited resources in how you're going to organize things. So I don't know if that's a starting point, and maybe we
Well, so
could
one of
go
the
deeper into
reasons that
whatever.
the one of the reasons that the communist systems don't work is that if the government is producing everything, then they've done away with the price mechanism. If you don't have the
Yeah,
price
this was
mechanism.
the one of the ultimate Austrian economists of the 20th century was Ludwig von Mises, and he wrote a book about the coming failure of socialism or communism about 1920, and it was the German edition, and then it came out later in English, that essentially made this critique of especially the real, the Soviet system that was going to do away with prices and money. And he said, predicting at the end is, you don't know what to produce. And that's all the factors of productions. I noticed in the slide you showed, they had the noted the book I, Pencil, which goes into something as simple, seemingly as simple as a pencil, and this enormous chain of production that's necessary to make a pencil. And all the decisions that are necessary into, what to produce, what quality, how much, etc., only could come from it following somewhere and interacting. Talk about information explosion, or the sense of what it would take to think of all those things. I mean, people in the 30s and 40s thinking ahead of computers, thinking, oh, someday, we'll have a big enough computer to do that. I don't think so, but it is an incredible amount of information that's stored in any particular price. So
So, Rick, what do you think of that in terms of the real world of business?
There's a lot there. Business is arbitrage. That's all that business is. It's competitive arbitrage. And the two of the things that were named on that slide were the ideas of space and time and their connections that it has with value and price. And I'll talk about here in a second what value and what price are and how they're related. But there's a third thing here that von Mises, that Ira just mentioned, discusses at length in his book, Human Action. And that is the idea of goals or wish fulfillment or the personalized value that someone gives something. And that's important. That's where price comes in. Price is the manifestation of value. Price is the manifestation of value. Then from price is where you get the information needed in order to create an efficient market to buy and sell, right? You have to have a buy side and a sell side. And ideally, you have some inventory in there and some liquidity in there to make any market work, whether it's commercial real estate or it's Microsoft stock. And so you have all these things working together. It used to be 100 years ago that the space and time elements, you could buy a stock on one market and go to another market. Maybe you buy something on the Paris stock market and you go buy the equivalent, the derivative of it in the US market, and you're able to trade it back and forth. You saw the carry trade blow up in our faces very recently with the yen trade, and it blew up the Nikkei. And you see this happening very much about 100 years ago, but now it's not very common that you would arbitrage based off the value of one thing, whether it's a man hour of a registered nurse at a hospital in Houston versus New York, or it is the value of gold, an ounce of gold here or in London. And so the space arbitrage has essentially gone away because we've become more of a connected society. With that connection, with the enablement of information, the second factor has gone away, which is the idea of time. It has completely gone away, but it's gone away quite a bit that you have more stability in certain things. If you take out the black swan events, you kind of go back to more Gaussian type of worldview, which I think we talked about a little bit last time, Karen. But for the most part, the time element has slowed down, has been tempered. So then what you're left with is this idea that something is worth more to me than it is worth to the counterparty. So what does this mean for the normal person that's got a regular 8 to 5 job? Why should they care about this conversation that we're having today? The care should be that if I'm a programmer at a company and I've been there for 20 years, I know what's happening, but I program and I do my job really, really well. But I haven't gotten any better, and productivity and efficiency is a big part of economics. That I should care that if the kids coming out of college, although they only work, half the time, half the number of hours I have, but they're 3 times as productive and they're half the salary. Well, the boss is incentivized to swap me out for that person, and so I have to see not only the price of what I'm paid or what I cost the company, but also the value that I bring on the income side. And sometimes cost and value are better thought of as expenses and income in certain scenarios. And so I think that's a sort of a broad reason why A, people that are not economically inclined should be listening to this podcast and to you, Karen, and then B, what the relationships are between these critical factors of arbitrage factors and also what value and cost mean to each other.
I would just add, just to what Rick was saying, just historically, this fundamental aspect of the price coming in terms of a value is the Austrians, what the real Austrian Revolution, the basis of it in the 19th century was the subjective theory of value, that prices, values are subjective. It's the problem of what's the value of a price of a glass of water. To us, we have plumbing and things like that compared to somebody in the desert, who has no water. And we can go on and on with those things and comparing it to, say, a Marxian or even, I think actually even Smith, very much like a labor theory of value or a capital theory of value, where prices have some value based on some kind of a calculation of some inherent value, where the Austrian's basis is always people. And getting back to the information aspect, even a person at any given place or any given time can put a different value on something. I always used to say this, like sitting in a pub trying to talk about these things and say, well, look, if the price of beer were actually cheaper at the other end of the bar, wouldn't you go over there and buy a beer? Yeah, unless there was a line for the beer there where I could just get mine directly here if it was more expensive. You know, so that puts your time involved and all the things that go in. It's my subjective value of what that would be. And it's the entrepreneur who has the incredibly difficult task of doing this arbitrage in different places or times, of recognizing all these different factors to say, then what do the people really want at what price? And that's a super, you know, there's lots of great products that came out with the wrong price. Or this development project is wonderful if, you know, you could have had apartments at, you know, $100,000 instead of $200,000, or whatever it would be. So, and that's this information. It is information, is there, but then analyzing it, putting it together as an entrepreneur is an enormously difficult task. And I think, you know, again, this is where governments really fail, because those calculations are made with political bias as opposed to really trying to meet what the market is desiring.
Yeah, and I think there's also a spiritual element to this as well, because you mentioned the Marxist ideologies of the left, where, you know, even in the Keynesian system, you have a government controlled economy where the government's pulling the levers to make the economy work. And they think that you really need the government in order to make businesses work properly. But on the more conservative side, the von Mises side, the Austrian economic side, you have this idea that it is the individuals, the right of the individuals, that control and a properly functioning society. And so the leftists, this is the Marxists from an economic standpoint, the leftists believe that they think of people in clusters of groups, like these are companies, these are organizations. But the Austrian side think of these groups, no, these are just collections of people. These are individual people with individual motives. And this is how we stimulate them to want to work. We get out of the way, we deregulatize. And that's the way that works. And so von Mises had something famous that he said. He said that economics is not mechanical, it's human. It's not mechanical in the Marxist sense, it's human.
It's the title of the book.
It's dignifying, and it's dignifying, yeah. Is it really?
And I think the other thing is that Keynesian economics and Galbraith and all those guys, they looked at an economic system as a way to make the world they wanted it to be. And Austrian economics just describes the world the way it is.
Actually, that's the point I was just about to make here, and I think is really important. And Mises, I think, was pretty much an atheist. I mean, he was a Jewish background. He touches on aspect of religion or spiritual aspects as being one of all the other things that make up psychologically why you have a particular value that's subjective, you know, what you're going to spend. So in other words, we can see very well the market can provide porn extremely well, you know, if there's a demand, and that won't make for a good society. So, you know, there's a limit of what the economics can do and in terms of understanding what we want in a society. Even though we want, I will certainly want freedom, I want capitalism, but I think, you know, we have a lot of disorder in our world today that comes because the people in the market practicing capitalism are disordered. Spiritually, we can say from the sense of religious, you know, not having meaning or whatever, their subjective values are going to be really wrong. But the market will go right ahead and, you know, produce those wrong directions in terms of a good life, say, or our definition of what a good life could be. And I think that's a huge question in my mind about to say of what capitalism should be or could be, or how do we deal with that as a society?
I totally agree with that. And I also want to say that the price mechanism is our system of information, basically, within, I'll say Austrian economics, but let's just say the way that economics works in the world. But the limit, the restraint that happens in the world is individual greed. Individual greed is actually the, not that it's a good thing, but it is the thing that keeps an economic system functioning when there is no regulation coming in from the outside. Maybe individual greed is the wrong word, but individual self-interest. Because yes, porn could completely take over the economy. That's what everybody wants. And if the price is right, it's going to be available to everybody. But individuals also have personal decisions that they can make about whether to participate or not. There can be movements that go through the society that say, we're not going to have anything to do with porn. That's going to reduce the market. It's going to make it harder to sell or whatever, because each person is making a decision about what price they're willing to pay for something. And people will also think, are we willing to pay the societal price for allowing porn to take over our world? And that's a question that the US has been wrestling with for like 100 years, right? So that the price mechanism has to function with the human conscience and the human way of thinking about things, making these decisions about what we're willing to pay, what we're willing to give up. You know, am I willing to give this up? If you give me three cows for my painting, am I willing to give up my painting? So on the other hand, if you have a cow, am I willing to give you one of my paintings for a cow? And that always comes down to this. It's a system of information. And the reason I think this is important is not because people might be listening, interested in whether they can get good money for their job or get good value for their products. But I think this actually drives all the way down into the way cellular mechanisms work and in the way that organisms function and in the way that societies on the larger scale function. It all comes down to what is your avenue of information for making choices so that things are constructed and come to completeness, come to wholeness. And it has to me it ha that this price mechanism is very, very fundamental thing, which is why it kind of tickled me that this guy is talking to Michael Levin, because he has seen that price mechanism is somehow fundamental to this whole issue of collective intelligence. So one of the things he talked about, maybe I could show you this, show you an essay of his. It's got a little something written in there. Prices is cognitive glue. I think that's it. Can you see? You can see the screen. It says interesting essays. There should be a text running through the center of the screen.
Looks more like a how human ideas, behaviors, and effect of the impact. I don't see interesting essays.
Oh, that's just the title at the top.
It's from DC Schindler, several things, yeah.
Oh, okay. So then I got the wrong screen up somehow. I apologize. I'm not very good at the share screen thing. Oh, here it is. I think that's it. Now you can see.
Okay.
You see a text running through there?
Yes. Memory is
okay.
Meaning.
Yeah. So motor behavior is complex. This is what he's talking about. And he says, so let's say that you've been attacked, that's a prey has been attacked by a predator. I don't know. A gazelle is running through the field and gets attacked by a tiger. Some people would say that you have a fight or flight system built in. So when the predator is coming along, you just flee. But he says there's actually many, many, many more variables that have to be considered, and that it could never be something that's just built into the system. This fleeing mechanism doesn't really work as itself without all of these other variables. And so he has... So for example, he says, the problem with this idea is that there are very few, if any, survival situations where obligatory pre-programmed responses are useful. It seems logical to say that when you see a predator, you should run. But just like the walking category hides an immense amount of important variability in motor behavior, the predator attack category also neglects important detail. Has the tiger seen you? Is it an adult tiger or a juvenile? How far away is the tiger? Are you above it, with it, below it? Is the terrain muddy or firm? Are there places to hide or are there weapons you can pick up? Is it night or day? Are you healthy or lame? Have you eaten recently? Are you hydrated? Are other people with you? And so on. Of course, all of these would be things that people would take into account with a price mechanism as well, right?
I guess my take on this is maybe I question it in the sense, if we take all of biology, like you say, from the cellular level, you know, up through what a tiger does or what even is we do as human beings, the laws of, say, physics are certainly applicable, and which include, I think, we have limited resources. And, you know, even like the combinatorial explosions of Verveke, we have to make decisions about what to do and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't necessarily see where the price comes in. You know, subjective theory of value, it gives prices. That's the information about what other human beings should be doing to meet the needs of another human being. I don't know like how herd animals would have a price, you know, in between themselves to make the choices.
Well, okay, so that's a very good question. So let's attack from that standpoint. What is a price really saying at the fundamental level? And Rick, do you have something to say about that?
Yeah, so let's get back to what we're talking about, money. We're talking about the money, money is exchanged. There's this word called fungibility or fungible. Money is fungible. It means it can be traded for other things. It means I don't have to take my cow and trade it directly for artwork and, you know, trade it for wheat. I can take money and I can use that one thing to trade it for multiple things. We've all agreed that that money has some sort of value. So the fungibility of money is very important. Now, the idea that you began your comments with, Karen, which I thought were fantastic, the idea of sort of the greedy man, I think what you're, and you said this kind of painting in a good light. I think that, and I think I would agree with you on that. It's the man that understands that cooperation is necessary in order to get value to be exchanged, in order to really to make your money go as far as possible. Because if you hate me, I may pay a premium for something. And if enough people hate me, they're not going to do business with me, or it's going to be highly inefficient in order to do business. And so you think about Simon Sinek talks about the idea of the ultimate game, that you want to get as many people as possible that are willing to play with you. That's what the best greedy man, the one that's most successful, they have as many business partners or people that want to exchange this value with them as possible. Now, if you take that down to sort of the natural level, you got to think about like what is the fungibility at the natural level? And it's hard to do that if you think very broadly about the different laws and the different processes there. And we probably should get to some point later on about the idea of what Mises said about evolution and Darwin. But for now, I think that the idea of fungibility is probably constrained to the idea of either sort of like the movement of the electrons, light, or maybe even DNA. I think there's probably two or three different themes there that are maybe have to deal with fungibility that allow you to maneuver and do different things with the same given set. From my standpoint, I'm thinking about the maneuverability, the fungibility of money as probably one of those three things or something like those three, something like light, something like electrons, something like DNA from that aspect. Because that's where you get cooperation. That's where you get options. And options are what are key.
And I want to throw in here another piece, and that would be that in one way, price is a mechanism of sacrifice. What am I willing to sacrifice right now to get what I want in the future? And so we have a gazelle running through the field with a tiger running after it, and there's all of these variables that means that it doesn't have a built-in sense of what to do. It somehow has to make decisions based on these variables. And then it also somehow has to make decisions based on how much sacrifice it's willing to make, because some gazelles will stay back and let the tiger get it so that maybe the baby can survive or maybe the herd can survive. And that's a different price. But it's a price, nevertheless. It's a price. And
I would just say, like, maybe if we get back to the information flow, because I'm very much, you know, Rick emphasized, it's the title of Van Bisi's big book, is Human Action. You know, how are humans acting different than animals? You know, having subjective values that then can be expressed as prices. How is that happening on a cellular level?
I don't see necessarily how that's working.
But the problems that you're trying to solve, that the price gives you information about to solve, are always there. We've got to act. We got to make what choice? Which direction are we going? What are we going to buy? What are we not going to buy? What are you sell? The price gives you information to act, whereas in the animal world, say, or whatever, there's information exchange, but it's not by prices. I don't know how they necessarily do.
Okay, I'm not making myself very clear. Let me try one more approach. Let's say that these things all scale. You have the human scale, and then you have the scale of where it works, where else in the world where it works. Okay. And imagine a cell, and imagine a zygote. And so out of that zygote is eventually going to come a full-blown human being. On the way, it doesn't have enough information from the DNA to determine whether or not both arms are going to be the same length and how to get that same length out of both arms. So when the cells that are going to build an arm go over there to build an arm, I always want you to imagine their environment. You have all these cells moving around in an immensely variable environment with all sorts of possibilities around. And somehow they have to navigate into a way of building an arm or building an eye or whatever it is that they're doing. Somehow those cells are making some kind of a choice. Now, Levin talks about the cognitive, he talks about bioelectrical signals as being the cognitive glue that are holding those cells together. But Benjamin Lyons is proposing that perhaps it's like the price mechanism that is guiding them. Every time, if I could think computationally, let's say every time I get to a juncture, I'm either going to choose one or zero. Eventually, that's all going to add up to something, depending on what choice I make at each juncture. That's how my life is built. I've run into a series of ones and zeros my whole life, and now here I am. And the cells are doing the same thing. And I think that they're doing that based on all the information that's surrounding them. Now, they're not doing it the same way we do it in terms of cognitively, rationally processing all that information, but there's got to be some way that they are intersecting with that information. And I think it works similar to a price mechanism. So, Rick, back to you.
Yeah. You know, that makes a lot of sense too, right? It's a very Darwinian looking thing anyway, kind of like, how do these cells are going to survive? Well, you're going to become an ear, you're going to become a nose. This is how we're going to kind of maneuver ourselves. We're going to cooperate, right, to be able to survive.
Well, actually, Levin says that there's some kind of a subroutine that notifies the cells, first of all, what they're going to become. And then after they get into that little subunit, there's a subroutine that they run that becomes that thing. It's really not very Darwinian the way he describes it.
Yeah, kind of like having 3 billion lines of code somewhere hidden.
But their
objective, I think, from the secular standpoint, is they're all sort of fighting to survive, and that's why they kind of differentiate themselves and they try to split up because they want to survive in that Darwinian aspect. But if I said the same thing about you, it would be a very Marxist thing to say. It would be the very thing that the same economist that once you want to give all the power to the government, all the controls of the government would want to say, but not the thing that the Australian Austrian economists would want to say we want to give all the rights to the individual and all the power to the individual. I'm just trying to reconnect these things here. But I think what von Mises says very early in his book, maybe page 170, 180, something like that, that, you know, Darwin said that when we were in that cage with the tiger, you know, we were fighting for survival. It was always survival of the fittest. But the smart man, the smart woman realized that if I'm going to try to always survive, and if someone threatens me, what Darwin would say is like, I should probably go ahead and defend myself. And if I have to defend myself repeatedly, I should probably go ahead and kill the individual. Just to provide a very, very brief summary of that and over approximation of that. But the idea that if I figure out that if I can cooperate with you, give me a good amount of cooperation, if I can cooperate with you, we can eventually create a relationship that even if I have to defeat you in a battle or you have to defeat me in a negotiation, if I do it with dignity in a way that you're going to want to trade and reciprocate with me potentially in the future, I've just increased my network by 100%. And then 50%, and then 25%, and so on. So I built a sort of a network of value, a network of cooperation that looks probably a lot like sort of this cellular level of cooperation that emerges in nature. So you sort of begin to see this in society emerge. And so Mises does I'm not doing it justice, obviously, but Mises does a really great job in Human Action, just really tearing apart Darwin's idea that survival of the fittest is happening because you see so much cooperation. And that's what our entire globe is made of, is cooperation. And the cooperation, what is it driven by? It's driven by the fungibility of money. And the fungibility of money is built on cooperation itself, an agreement of what the value is in approximation of what the dollar is or whatever the fiat currency is. And so, yeah, I certainly see some similarities there.
Well, maybe I can synthesize this a little bit and try to get back to try to agree more with what Jaron was saying. From my distinction of pricing, you know, but using money is a distinctly high-level human action. But what is like that in the natural world on every level is diffuse communication. You know, by prices, the money and everything else, I don't think that exists anywhere else except on this human level. But the sense of a cell can send out, I don't know, a chemical signal that then gets distributed among all the other cells that then allows that the other cells to recognize some important aspect of their communal life together, which again, you can have communal life for thousands of years, maybe without money, without pricing per se, but the sense of people need to live together, socialize, you know, that aspect like you were talking about, beginning of human society, that human beings are much, much more successful together in a group than by themselves. Say, as one thing, as a bit of information that can then pass among them just by even speaking about it or something else than to cooperate together. So there, again, if we get back to fundamental, there has to be, in growing the two arms the same length, there needs to be information that needs to be passed along to millions of individual cells and what they're doing. There has to be some mode of information transfer that on a world economic level is through prices. What is it at the level of those arms that are growing? That's, you know, that's a whole other story to me. It's a different kind of distributed information transfer than what is on the social economic level of human beings, our prices.
Well, okay, so that's the difference and the connection. Just a semantic, I think that's just a semantic difference, because what we're looking at, what I'm trying to get at is, what is that thing that you just described? You know, at a meta level, if that thing is the same kind of thing as the price mechanism on the human level, then there's some meta level at which they are all the same concept. And what is that bigger concept? That's what I'm driving at. Thank you.
Well, that could be, except if you've studied economics, this aspect of price is way, way too important to mix up. We got to keep this straight, because otherwise you ruin everything. You know, that's the Austrian economics.
And of course, with my great influence in the world, I'm sure I'm going to mess things. Nobody's listening, you know. I'm just trying to get at it myself. What is this thing?
Yeah, and I see kind of what we're doing here. We're looking sort of at the fractality of both, right? There's some similarities, there's some mirroring what happens in nature, right? We didn't come up with the idea of a cooperation just out of thin air. Like we got it from somewhere, and perhaps it's written into the code of our DNA that sort of kind of matriculated up the chain, or maybe we got it from Genesis chapter 1 of whose image we were made in. And so it could have come top down as well. But I see what Ira is talking about there, and I see what you're talking about, Karen. And I think that it's probably a little bit of a both and, right? Like if we work together, we can eat tiger meat.
If we work together, we can.
If we cooperated, we could eat tiger meat.
Oh,
right. If you're that focused on cooperation, and you knew there were tigers out there, you would never send a person out unarmed or alone. And so I think that's a little bit what, you know, larger businesses are being about, organizations are being about. We're being more protective, being more communal in nature, because we realize there's such a thing as tiger meat. There's not just tigers.
Well, I guess so one other thing I could add to the conversation is a question. On this higher level of human beings, we've talked about a price mechanism as a way of distributing information. But I think there are other ways of doing that. You know, this is what in families, you know, maybe parents distribute information. And on and on and on, we can go to larger organizations or bottom-up type things of distributing information that's important to everybody who's receiving it and how it's going and mixing back and forth. Where pricing is one particular type, and it's interesting also, price, what's fundamental to it is it's quantitative, which, again, I don't see in nature in such a precise way as it occurs. But as an entrepreneur, you have many, many other aspects of information coming and going, and I would think, and communication that's part of your decision-making process than simply certain prices.
Yeah, certainly. And if you understand motivation, that helps a lot because it gets more efficient, right? I don't have to guess around whether or not I've got to beat out the other employer to pay you a higher salary. If I know you really care about, you know, work-life balance, I know you really care about taking a month off during the summer to go spend with your kids, that's a much different bargaining. It becomes more and more efficient there if you're talking about incentives and what the goals are. But I think it's also important to, this is sort of semantical as well, but I think it's definitely correlated, this idea of value, like sticking to value and looking at price as information, is that all value, the values that I give to my kids, the values I give to my wife, the values I talk about on YouTube, all those values are transmitted in information. Information is only the transporter of values in all its derivative forms. And I think that is something worth considering, in that we are sort of a value creation machine. I will set up false values that if I serve this God, or if I work extra hard for this client, or if I give this second glance to this very attractive woman walking by, well, my wife's not there, that will give me some sort of value or some sort of goal or some sort of benefit there. But I deceive myself. And so I think all the time we're looking around at values, we're looking for values, we're value seeking machines, but we see so many false values, and we've got to figure out a way, shortcuts to be able to get to figure out which ones are true values, which ones are false values, which ones we should discard. Like the employer that knows the employee really only wants to be off for a month in summertime, I keep some of my own value. I become a more lucrative investor, a more efficient investor, by knowing what values are true and what values are false. And so I think that's sort of part of my role as a value seeking machine.
So price provides information. Profit also provides a certain kind of information, right? So what's the difference in the kind of information that's provided by price as compared to that which is provided by profit?
I like Rick start. I would have an idea, but he's the guy who really does it. So I'll let him make the choice.
Okay. Well, throw me to the tigers first. I see how it is. All right. So the idea, a price is only an indicator of value, right? There's never a price unless there's a value for that, or value to maybe get rid of something. And the price can change over time. Price changes over circumstances. And so that does give us information. The more efficient the market, right, the more you know about everyone's intents and desires and goals and objectives and values, you can get a more streamlined and you get a quicker price as long as there's adequate bid and ask. There's got to be a bid. There's got to be a buyer for that specific thing that you're talking about, pricing and value. But there also has to be an efficient market for people wanting to sell those sorts of things, what they're asking. And as the market gets more and more efficient, this bid price people are willing to buy increases and the ask price decreases. And at some point, you'll get occasional trades that, you know, the price of gold, maybe 100 years ago, there were 100 different prices all over America, 150 years ago, 150 prices for all over America. But you'd have a bid that'd be one price, say, $100 an ounce. And there would be an ask that would be $150 an ounce. But if someone really, really needed gold, they may come up to 125. And the seller, if they need money, they would come down to 125 and you would have a trade. That's when a trade happens. That's when economic activity happens, when you have a bid and an ask price that are willing to meet. And the more frequently they meet, the more efficient the market is. In the long run, I'm going to let Ira correct me on this. But it seems to me that the more efficient the market is and the more value is understood. Now, when value is understood, it tells me a lot more about the intentions and the motivations of the society, or at least the purchasers and the sellers, than if there was no value and there was no efficient market there. And so we can read intentions, we can read goals, and we can also sometimes even read trends in that value and in the also the sort of the secondary areas, like a Markov blanket, for instance, of what all the derivative values may be. And you can see when changes may or may not be taking place. And so I guess that's the first half of your question. I'll let Ira finish it up or correct everything I just said.
Well, the part that I got from Karen, this differentiating between the price and the profit, I would say it comes down...
Differentiating what kind of information they provide.
Right. So there are prices out there the way Rick described them. He discussed the process by which prices come. You know, lots of people everywhere around are bidding and exchanging, and it comes to be there are certain prices. And then that brings information to somebody, say, who's making that pencil. And so there's a price on graphite, there's a price on wood, there's a price on labor, there's a price on transportation, and all those prices come together to form what he needs to produce his pencil. And then he has a choice, you know, to go through this process and make pencils, and then to put the pencil itself on the market and exchange it, and to see what it'll be exchanged for. And the prophet tells the entrepreneur and society, really, that all those other choices out there make sense for producing pencils, and how many pencils. If he can't make a profit with those prices out there, he shouldn't make pencils, because there are higher uses, valued uses for those materials, resources, labor, etc., than producing pencils. And that's the essential key to me of what the prophet is saying. That's what the Soviet Union missed. So we need shoes. Well, how many shoes? Well, let's make a million of this kind of shoes. All the other things, the millions of things that come into producing that, had other uses that they couldn't balance out of all those things. And that's what the prophet tells you, that you've made the right choices along the way. If you're far off, there's an aspect also of, say, let's say you find some new idea and you make huge profits. Well, that's information as well. That tells other people, hey, there's a real desire for this thing on the market. Let me try to reproduce it. If you lose lots of money, people are going, this Sony Betamax thing, maybe it's not the thing for the future, you know, whatever it would be. And we see that all the time in the market, you know, for the iPhone comes out, and there's all kinds of, they make a tremendous amount of money. There's all kinds of competitors. It's the profit that was the information that told them to do that. You know, they might have had the idea before, but until the profit was made, That's the very powerful information that, hey, there's a real desire for this particular type of product, say.
Are there times when a profit can be made when it gives you a different kind of information?
Well, I think there's all kinds of things, and this is where you get into all kinds of, the difference between, say, the Austrian economic theory of what's happening versus the reality of what's happening. Do we have markets? The one I was thinking about recently a lot is, with the world we live in today, is, say, the market for fighter aircraft. So certainly Lockheed's making lots of profit. Is that telling the world, yeah, that's what we need, more of those? Well, there is no real market. They have incredible influence on people in Congress who then vote to make this thing, and in the military. There's no other bidders in the whole process. It's just the back and forth thing. And the tremendous amount of money is taken out of the rest of the economy and into this thing that's now with billions or whatever it costs for each individual one of these things, that exactly how it's going to be used. So here's profit. Is that a market? We have to recognize if the fundamentals of where we think the information was generated are real. And so this has been, to me, what seems a real problem, where it seems at every point in the process, where I thought from an Austrian standpoint, say the government is intrusive, if we follow the government to its point of its, why are they intruding in a particular market, say, well, we see another economic actor at the other end who is gaining by this particular way of influencing the market. And as I say, is this an intractable problem for capitalism, that once it grows, that the best, and maybe they started as the best, eventually are going to take over government, and now they'll wreck what was the market. It won't be a market anymore. It won't be the real information flow. It won't be free actors making choices. It'll be this essentially socialized system, corporatist system, that does what it does. So it's got all the information issues, but then also a lot of political, moral issues, I would say, for us to try to figure out as individuals, what's going on and what to do about it.
So yeah, is late stage capitalism inevitable, Rick?
Yeah, I don't know if it's inevitable. That's the real question, I would say.
Yeah, I think what's important also, this idea of the larger companies, the defense contractors, like I mentioned, getting entangled in political lobbying that then create a stimulus, create new markets for things that really probably shouldn't exist. I think there's a lot of economic ingenuity that can happen there, entrepreneurial ingenuity to be specific, to be able to sort of navigate the nuances of operating in the federal space and the state space and all that sort of thing. And so I think there's not only sort of manipulation happening from the front end with a sort of on the lobbying angle there, but then whenever the bills come to pass, there's always smaller contractors that are sort of navigating the nuances of the bills and the intents and the DEI and the ESG and all that sort of thing, because they're looking for arbitrage opportunities. And the arbitrage opportunity there would clearly be, like, for a small business, if someone was watching your show and they want to start a small business, I think it would be a great opportunity to find one thing that a small kind of 3 to 5 person business could do. And you had some sort of certification, you had small business certification or minority certification, something like that, is a veteran certification, and go sell your services to a Lockheed. They need subcontractors to meet all these sort of hiring goals for subcontractors, and so does the federal government. And so as you get more tampering with the federal budget, you have various economic actors that are taking very entrepreneurial roles through there to be able to benefit and to see profit. And so that's certainly one way that you could see this profit come to fruition. The other way, which I think is probably the main way, and this is how Lockheed makes their money, is through creating barriers to entry, right? They've got a significant amount of IP, intellectual property, that prevents other people from building the sorts of systems that they have. And they also have significant engineering assets, engineering staffing, facilities, bases that they can build and test their weapons, their trades of commerce. And that allows them a competitive advantage. If you and I want to do that, we would need $100 billion in order just to set up enough business. And we still wouldn't have the talent to be able to compete against Lockheed. And so I think those are probably two of the more common ways to maximize profit is to create barriers of entry, intellectual property, significant manufacturing capacity, significant capital intensive types of processes, which is not accessible for most people. But then also trying to go into a space that's heavily regulated and try to capture some of the value there because of these sort of superfluous types of ESG and other sorts of mandates that require them to utilize small businesses and other sorts of businesses that have certain claims about their about their ownership and their efficacy.
Well, I mean, that's how to make the market work for you, but should we? I mean, you know, I mean, that's the question. Because what happens is the minute that the influence makers go in and convince the government to lean one way rather than another way, so all the money is flowing one way, there's incentive for everybody to jump on that train. Of course, everybody wants to get in on that. And that's driving us down an inevitable path of catastrophe.
Yes. And that's why the spending situation gets out of control, because you have new entrepreneurial interests getting into that side. So this is sort of the downstream of the lobbyists and the capital flow through the government coffers, through the mismanagement, the bureaus and that sort of thing of the federal government, through the larger contractors and these smaller contractors. And you not only have smaller contractors that are getting work for ESG purposes. I mean, it reminds me of certain politicians out there, your neck of the woods, Karen. But also people that are getting work that are very low on the competency scale. And they're also sort of ulterior motive actors. They're there for the political gain and for the arbitrage opportunity there for operating in one space. And you know, if I can do the same thing for a commercial client that I can do for a federal government client, the federal government's going to give me a 10-year contract and they're going to pay me 50% more, I'm going the government route. And that's where all of this begins to snowball and gets worse and worse and worse every single year. And without a changeover, without term limits, without the bureaucratic sort of the deep state people, I think is what a lot of people will refer to them as, being dislodged, it's going to be a continual problem. And that's why the spending gets worse. That's why the economic, the free market economy isn't able to propagate it as well as it's meant to, and it should, because we have sort of this bureaucracy there taxing the entirety of the economy because of its inefficiency.
I guess I would just add, you know, back to the original part of the conversation, is all this stuff, and we can go, you know, I certainly could go on and on and on and on about each individual type of industry, et cetera, where issues come up, to say the information that's in profit and the information that's in prices is no longer what we would say, I would say, is the free market price and the free market profit. And for that reason, it's not real information. It's something else. It certainly tells you something, but it's not the pricing information about real values of people and the resources available to meet those particular values. It's something else. And you can get into all the details of potentially of what that is, whose values are being served, but it isn't the general market. It's special actors that then, I would say, gain by this in various ways.
And when that information flow is interrupted in that way, it can be really catastrophic for the culture as a whole.
Yeah. I think you know, one of the classic ways.
Rick, do you have a hard stop?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah. 20, 30 minutes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would just add, you know, Karen, if you want to see, there's been several books. There's some nice, good, very good literature, say by Thomas Mann. There's a book by Guido Holzman about the moral effects of inflation. For example, you know, when you have a sound money, you know, that's not being inflated, that you have confidence in, you have confidence in the future. You can plan for the future. You get, you everything about then morally is in a different place than when this collapses. So there was a very good short story by Thomas Mann about this for the German inflation. So again, what you say is there's a feedback loop. You need kind of good moral people, honest people, say is one variable to create a market that builds and creates so much for so many, and it spirals up. But then once you start doing these bad things, it spirals all the way down the other way, that people become immoral in various ways because they can't trust. They can't trust other people. They can't trust the money. They can't trust the future. And then it's hard to have a civilized life at that point. You
well,
know,
so
when
the
it gets
feedback,
that bad.
The feedback loop is sort of the way you're describing it is when the economy gets to a certain place that you begin to place your trust in something above you that's not trustworthy, then that drives back down the other direction.
Yeah.
Would that describe it?
I think that at least that's part of it. I mean, these are to I'm just talking as, you know, as we're having a conversation, you know, to get to the nub of the matter in a precise kind of Vervaekian way, say, you know, where we put all this together so it goes through all directions,
mm-hmm.
you know, to take more. I would just say there certainly is an obvious fact that you can see historically and think it through, that once you say is the money I hold, I can't just hold it and save for, say, my children, but I have to invest it. I have to gamble it. I have to search big rewards. I'm going to have a different mindset, a different way of looking at the world in those two instances. And, you know, there's always the place for speculation. I think speculation can be a good thing. Entrepreneurship can be a good thing. But the general sense of people is to work, save, and then invest that saving into capital that will build more. I mean, that's civilization building. Trying to, you know, let me bet on futures or, you know, a money play or a carry trade or whatever it is, in making millions that way is not actually creating any new capital wealth that could then be passed on to the future. So I think those, again, the moral infects the economic infects the moral, and they both kind of need each other some way, or they're symbiotic or antagonistic to each other. That we seem to have tons of wealth these days, except I think there are millions of people now who realize they don't have very much. They've got millions, they got lots of things based on debt. Again, how you're thinking of the future is incorrect. And we'll see where all that comes to.
Over to you, Rick.
Yeah, I think if you want to start talking about inflation and it being sort of an evil type of a thing that, you know, it keeps people down, I think it's tough because, you know, from a physics standpoint, we look at inflation the same way as we look at friction. Friction is bad from a sort of physical engineering type of standpoint. You try to get rid of friction in a lot of circumstances. It kind of drags you down, literally, figuratively. And but you also have this inflation element there that holds you back over time. But then you also have this sort of this carry cost. And this is where the slippery slope could happen. You know, if society were to take up your position, Ira, that inflation is evil, is that the carry costs, the living expenses, would then shoot us very, very quickly into sort of a proto-Marxist type of agenda where our living expenses were taken care of by the federal government. And I think that we saw this happen in 2008 through 2012 with the ascent of Obamacare. Like we believe it's a right for every person to have, you know, to be dignified by having health insurance here in the United States. I know you're in France. And so, you know, they're going to take care of us. It's for our own safety. That's why the jets, that's why That's why Lockheed needs these contracts, is for, it's for our own safety. That's why we had various mandates. It's for our own safety. But nothing that the government does is very much for our safety. It's only for sort of the creativeness of power, and a lot of that always adds to inflation. And so I think that, and I guess this is a question for you, you know, where would you draw the line if we talk about, you know, combating inflation long term, if that's sort of an ethical stance for you, do we just want to take care of inflation, or do we want to take care of other things that tend to creep up in cost over time that prevent the accruement of wealth for future generations?
Well, I would say the sense of the pure monetary phenomena of inflation, you know, creating new money, fiat money that then goes into circulation, is a bad thing. You know, there's all kinds of bad things that happen from it. And when it eases, the problems it supposedly solves are really just the power and wealth transfer. You know, now, there are real problems of society that are beyond this purely monetary economic problem, you know, that people don't have health care, that people are poor. And this, again, this is where, you know, there's a real society that has information and cooperation outside the price economy. And I think you and Karen, you know, people, we all know this. We're involved in it, I'm sure. And so it's that sense of being able to recognize there are these two things. And I think when I was first reading of Austrian economics, because I could see sort of the kind of the atheistic side of, you know, the immoral side there. You know, there's no morality in Austrian economics, as Karen said earlier. It's just describing the way things work was there. And there was lots of kind of libertarians that said, well, you know, non-aggression principle, these economic laws, and boom, we're done. And I think at least a lot of the libertarians that I follow recognize that that's only part of the story. And there's much, much more that's necessary in terms of who the people are that are participating in the market for that to work. And those other things need to be addressed, not by economics per se, but as people, as people. And we could talk about theology, we could talk, you know, all kinds of different levels of where that comes into play, but it needs to be addressed. And so I think those libertarians in that way made a mistake, maybe in von Mises. I think Rothbard already was like one of the major students from von Mises, was already very much recognizing, I think, this particular kind of issue, the social as well as the economic that are intertwined, that needs to be addressed by people who want to live a free and good, in a good society. That it's not just having free prices. That won't do it. There needs to be something else.
Yeah, you said something interesting a second ago about what happens to the inflation. Did you say that inflation just goes to make rich people richer?
Well, I would say in the sense of if you literally follow the money, when you say the Federal Reserve or whoever creates the money, you know, who gets it? If they print treasury bonds and sell them, who makes a profit when they sell the bonds? When a bank can create money and lend it, who makes the money? I mean, when you're like at the end, the first one to get that borrowed money, and you're in Silicon Valley, and you know, you're getting the lowest interest rate and all that money, you know, it's like the end of the, when the spigot is shooting out the money, who gets it first? And that ain't the average person, you know.
And did you mention Rothschild? Did you mention Rothschild?
No.
Well, it could be the Rothschild any bank, you know.
Okay.
Oh, no, that's Rothschild. Rothbard.
That was going to go a whole more exciting.
Oh, no, we're not going to go down that road. No. Murray Rothbard was a great thinker. Yeah. That was who he mentioned. Yeah.
Okay. That would confuse things. I'm not saying that. Okay. No, so Rothbard, he wrote a great little book about, you know, the mystery of central banking, I think. It's okay. You know, a little booklet that's really nice, and is huge tracks of the history and then analyzing the mechanisms of how these things come together. He's probably one of the best I know of trying to make this complex weave of trying to be able to understand and explain it, because it is so complex and so easily hidden from average people of what the heck is going on.
And I think that's important. I want to try to tie this back to like the real life of the people that might be watching Karen's podcast on a regular basis. Like, what's if inflation is going to be a given probably until we're all dead, I would imagine, at least for the next 100, at least next 1,000 years, there's be some sort of inflationary element to whatever we do in the long term. So why does inflation always benefit the rich for the most part? It benefits the banks, it benefits different governments, and it benefits a variety of people. But in the end, it benefits the people that have the highest level of competency and who are best positioned to benefit for that. And obviously, the person with the best position is the one that has the most options. The one with the most options is generally the person that has the highest level of tactical competency within that area of work or investment. And they just seem to always be in the right place at the right time. And so it's not because, in my opinion, it's not because they were already rich and they just get richer. It's because they were competent, and competent people tend to find place themselves in areas where they're best positioned. That's why it always happens. They look, see, well, inflation's coming for another 1,000 years. I'm going to be where inflation at least gives me a partial benefit. And they best position themselves. If I'm in a dying business, like I own an office building. Office building is a horrible business right now. It's a horrible investment decision, but I didn't know that, a number of years ago whenever I bought that. And so I'm not adequately positioned. So now my next idea is, like, how do I either get out of that, how to refinance it, how do I, do something to be able to put myself in sort of the second best position of not having bought it, but whatever that second best position is, I got to find what that position is, and it's incumbent on my competency to get me there. And the lower my competency is, more slower it's going to take for me to get there.
I'll take that comment in what I think you're right in the sense of as the inflation moves through the economy, all actors are have to deal with it. Everybody's finding their ways. And, as successful as you are as an entrepreneur, Rick, I consider you way down the totem pole from those guys
Bottom.
who are really there getting the money. I mean, and the first and foremost people who gain from the inflation is the government. They're always
Yes.
the one. Originally it was the king, clipping the coins or debasing the material in the coins. And then they have the coin and they say only my coins with my face on it can be used for exchange. And so they would be the obvious winner in all this, and then everybody else has to deal with it. But as an individual, somebody way down at my level, is like, well, I see the inflation is always going to be there. I'm going to have some gold and put it somewhere and da da da, or do whatever. That in the end, I could come out, I'll put in quotes ahead.
Yeah.
Or at least I can deal with it on a reasonable basis. But that's not being able to count on the good information that comes from real pricing from sound money that could help me and then the whole economy around me to live better. Whereas those people who get the money first really do, because they still have the same prices below that were before the inflation. And even though there's a continuous process, imagine it in a step function. So they get the money and there's still prices that are low and they get to use it. So it's that at least is a minimum that aspect, whoever gets it first, the money's created, who gets to spend it first, have a big advantage.
Yes.
And just at a very simple level, the people that are hurt the most are the people that are on a fixed income of some sort. I mean,
Of course, yeah.
there's absolutely even an inflation of 2-3% a year is going to impact people who have a fixed income.
No, I like that the
But
2%
when we make
target
it
came out
like
of nowhere.
10% a year, it's
Yeah.
catastrophic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, We've gone far afield from the original concept for the conversation, but I think we've covered a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Do we have something positive to end on? Because this is kind of a ne negative.
I guess I could take a shot at what's positive is Karen is there are people like you and Rick, who are, I think more than when I was first reading this kind of stuff 30, 40 years ago, and even among the people who I was reading, of recognizing there are all these fundamental issues and maybe, looking for where are the commonalities to the way cells grow, build a body and the way the economy sends information that maybe I disagree on a academic level about how this works. Focusing attention on, back to our Verveke's and Pajot's, how important that is about what is going on. How do we cooperate? How do we make choices in the world? And how much economics, as von Mises said, is fundamental human action, how that is involved, and then we could branch it into all these other areas, is something that's good that people are having the conversation. And I think, to me, as I follow from, as I'm speaking in French, a côté, next to, all the conversations in the TLC, for example, it's just, I'm really thrilled to hear average people, I'll say average in quotes, people having conversations that are really meaningful in the sense of getting into these complex topics and discussing them at a level where everybody can take something else away and build on it. So inflation is, I think, one of those. I mean, remember Ron Paul and things like that. Everybody should know what's going on with the central bank. Just that having people say, "What are you doing? Explain what you're doing." It was all audit the Fed. Give us that information again, at a minimum, and I think that makes quite a bit of a difference. So, the conversation is what's good, and I think that's my positive take about our little conversation, but what's happening in a bigger sense.
And so I think there's a lot of hope coming from this conversation as well, Karen. If I'm an average viewer and I'm watching this, I'm hearing some big terms, I'm hearing some different things thrown around. I'm looking for something to grasp for, something that can put meaning in my life. And so I think that I should be encouraged, one, and that person should be encouraged, number one, that business is merely cooperation. Business is a series of individuals that are cooperating for one reason or another, is because that, and this is number two, that it's more efficient for that person to pay someone else to do something for them, whether it's manufacture the pencil like Ira talked about, or to sweep some floors, or to pick up some trash, or whatever it might be, or to build a jet. There's more efficiency there, and so business is arbitrage. Like I started off, it's what I value. My time and my effort, and my materials. If I'm sort of a lone entrepreneur, someone else is going to put more value on what I value my time for. If you find that right market, and that's where that trade should happen. But then also business and cooperation. So it's possible for that person that you're trading with, and you to find someone else that would want to trade the same way, that maybe their time is worth more to you because you could sell it to somebody else for more. There's an additional arbitrage there on the purchase of someone else's time. And you sell it for someone else. So it's a double arbitrage. That's what employment is. It's a double arbitrage of time. It's a double trade, if you will. There's an inefficiency there. And that's a very simplistic framework of how the markets work. It's a very simplistic framework of how business works. But if I am from a young man or a young woman trying to figure out, how can I get ahead, I can take something like that and begin to think about that. Is there someone that I could go talk to, and there's something I could sell them. Like, I don't have any skills. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have any manufacturing facilities. I don't have any money, but there's something I can sell. I guarantee you there's something that you could sell someone. You could go knock on the gas station's attendant's door and ask to, help clean up. You can do something for someone, and someone will pay you for that. And so I think that's one thing that gives us hope. It's not exciting hope. It's not ego boosting hope, but it's hope that we can get ahead. and that we can also provide a very holistic and very moral framework of how to get ahead, and that is through cooperation and through the idea of arbitrage, where I can provide more value to someone than what they think it's worth them giving me the money for. And so those are two areas of hope I think sort of the normal person can get from this conversation, Karen.
Well, and I, on that note, I also want to tell everybody that's still listening that there is going to be a conference in Olympia, Washington, September 12th through the 15th on encountering face-to-face. So it's going to be a very exciting conference. There's six speakers. I'll put all the information in the description section. And I get to be one of the speakers, so I'm pretty excited about that, although I haven't yet figured out a way to take all the stuff that's out there and put it into a 15-minute talk. But I'm working
on it. You have a title to your talk?
I think the general idea of the conference is witness. The general theme is witness. But they don't mean witness in the sense of giving a testimony of conversion or anything like that, but more in the sense of what does it mean to see something, to observe, to focus, to put your attention on something? Because that's the Verbakian, Peugeotian universe, right? And it's also an estuary conference, which means that there are going to be a number of estuary groups set up during the conference. So we'll get to know each other very well. So I'm really excited about that.
I wish I could go, but far away.
That's a long flight. Yeah. Long flight for you.
Well, I think I need to head out. So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me, Rick. Thank you, Ira.
Nice to meet you, Rick.
All the way from France and Texas and von Mises. So
yeah.
Great.
Bye.
See you soon, I hope. Bye bye.
Yeah.
All right. Hey guys, thanks a lot.